Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Welcome back to the Push Podcast.
Welcome.
I'm Sydney. I am a labor and delivery nurse and an online content creator in the birth postpartum education world.
And I'm Megan McGratton. I am an OBGYN as well as a clinical researcher. And Sydney, you're looking awfully cozy today.
I am feeling very cozy. We are wearing our new Gelb Malad sweatshirts.
We are.
They're so cute. They sent us these and we love them.
We love them so much. I was very excited to see some hoodies in the mix.
I have had the privilege of having quite a few sweatshirts and products from Gelb Malad over the years. And this was Megan's first time experiencing it. And she loved it. So thank you, Gelb Malad.
Thank you, Gelb Malad.
We love them. They're very cozy. It's perfect for this fall evening we have here.
Perfect for this
Toronto.
Fall evening.
Yeah.
We feel so fortunate to have the support of an incredible Canadian company.
Yes.
And having worn their scrubs before, we can also sign off on those. They're super comfy.
They're amazing. And they come in so many cute colors and sizes.
It's hard to be as comfy as a hoodie.
Honestly.
But the scrubs do a pretty good job.
They do, right?
Yeah.
I know. They're amazing. If you haven't checked out Gelb Malad, go give them some love. They're amazing.
Please do. As somebody who has many brands of scrubs, I really, really like the Gelb Malad ones. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Gelb Malad, and give them a check.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So today, what are we talking about?
So today we are actually doing a topic that has been requested by some of my patients, of all people. Mm-hmm. So I have reached the stage now. We're filming this a little bit later in the rollout of the podcast.
Yeah.
And I am starting to, you know, get comments from the people who are coming to see me in clinic, which is really
amazing.
It's so amazing. I love getting the feedback. It is interesting to me as somebody who's not been involved in the social media sphere to have that be kind of recognized.
Yeah.
But it's also provided me the opportunity to have some really interesting conversations with patients about things that they think are meaningful and important and helpful to them.
Yeah.
And so today we're doing a much requested topic.
Yeah.
Which is cervical cancer screening. Or what we might more commonly know of as the Pap test.
The Pap test.
So today we're going to explain what Pap tests really are, how they've changed cancer rates overall, why HPV is so important to our discussion of cervical cancer screening, and what the new guidelines in Ontario and ultimately the rollout elsewhere means for you and your gynecologic health.
Yeah, I think it's confusing because most of us grew up being told, you know, to book your pap test, book your pap smear, but the rules, you know, are changing and...
They've changed even over our lifetime.
That's the thing, right? So it's hard to keep track of it. Yeah. And, you know, we all want to do what's best for our bodies and our health. So we're going to talk about what is HPV and, you know, can you just swab at home? Like, that's a question that is frequently circulates online.
Yeah.
Let's dive into it. This is your area of expertise and I'm excited to hear about it.
I'm really excited to talk about it too, because I do colposcopy, which we will get into a little bit later.
Yeah.
And so I find that this is very reminiscent of conversations and a lot of unpacking that I'm doing in real time in my actual day job.
For sure.
But let's back up for a second. What is a pap test actually, right? Like, there are lots of patients and lots of places in the world where pap tests are not necessarily as commonly discussed or known as they are here in North America. So in brief, a pap smear or a pap test is performed. It is a test of the cervix and of the cells that line kind of where the inner aspect of the cervix meets the outer aspect.
Yes.
It's performed by opening the vagina with a speculum. So that duct-billed device that allows us to see inside of the vagina, and then collecting cells at the outer opening of the cervix at the transformation zone, which is again where outer squamous cervical cells meet the inner glandular endocervical cells. Mm-hmm. That's done usually with a spatula device or with a little brush. Mm-hmm. These collected cells are then put in liquid that we're able to then send off to the lab where they're looked at under a microscope to look for abnormalities. Yeah. And this test actually aims to detect precancerous cells of the cervix before they become cervical cancer.
Yeah.
But I think what's important to frame right from the get-go is Pap tests don't look for everything, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. I was under the impression before I went to medical school that a Pap test looks for things like sexually transmitted infections,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It does not. A Pap yeah. test looks for abnormal cells of the cervix that will develop into, or that have the potential to develop into cervical cancer.
Yeah.
It does not look for sexually transmitted infections like chlamydia, gonorrhea, herpes, or HIV.
Nope.
Those certainly test those, gonorrhea and chlamydia, for instance, can be swapped for at the same time as a Pap test.
That's what I was just going to say. You can have mm-hmm. all of these tested at the same time if it's something that you yeah. are wanting.
But it is not necessarily always
the exact same thing.
Exactly. Yeah. It also doesn't look for other gynecologic cancers like ovarian cancer, for instance.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always look for things like pelvic infections or mm. conditions like bacterial vaginosis, yeast, pelvic inflammatory disease, or endometriosis.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you have symptoms like abnormal bleeding, pain, discharge, those do need separate evaluations. Now they can yeah. be rolled into the same, you know, exam as a Pap test, but yeah. important to know that they are distinct.
Yeah. Now, Megan, I want to know kind of the history of the Pap test and where it came from. What's the historical features of the Pap test? What does that look like?
I love this. And it's surprising that I was not part of like the history of medicine clubs in med school.
I feel like you like history.
I love history. Oh my
she
God.
Just told me she got a pass to the ROM.
I did.
Yes. And I just feel like
the Royal Ontario Museum.
Yeah.
For those non-Torontonians.
Yeah. But I just feel like museums and history is like your thing. It's your bread and butter.
Love. I was one of those like really geeky little kids who was like sitting reading like Greek mythology for kids yeah. when I was little.
It's interesting to know, like from a health perspective for me, like the history of things too. I love this part of like our episodes is when we dive into the history.
Well, I think it's important to understand where we came from so that we can appreciate yeah. where we are today as yeah. well. As much as for like the clinical relevance as yeah. as well as for like, again, the understanding of the evolution of medicine yes. in general.
Yeah.
So the thing to know about Pap tests is that they are one of the most successful cancer screening programs ever.
Wow.
Right? We bemoan a lot, and rightly so, yeah. right? That like women's health in general has not traditionally been very well studied and certainly mm. not well funded compared mm. to other healthcare items.
Yeah.
But this is one area where we like really got something incredible and got it early. So the technique of the Pap test was widely introduced in the 1940s and 50s. Mm-hmm. And the person that discovered it or that is, you know, largely credited for this is Dr. George Papanikolaou, who developed the technique. Now, Dr. Papanikolaou was a Greek physician and a lab scientist who was working at Cornell at the time of the discovery.
Okay.
He was also working alongside his wife, Andromache. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, who worked alongside him as a lab technician. Mm. Now, when he first immigrated to the United States, mm-hmm. he was trained as a physician, is my understanding, in Greece, but he was not able to practice as a physician at that time. So he developed and was able to work in the lab at Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of the discovery, he was observing the ovulatory cycles of guinea pigs. Mm. But because he wasn't an MD, he lacked access to patients. So his wife, actually, as they were beginning to observe the ovulatory changes of these guinea pigs and develop this hypothesis in their head, she actually volunteered as an experimental subject for her husband mm. And was able to provide swab samples for close to 21 years.
Wow.
So as with many things, there's kind of an untold story of mm-hmm. a woman pioneer in the background mm-hmm. of his very like appropriately accredited discovery,
yeah,
right? But
yeah.
important to remember her in the context of
Absolutely.
This as well. Now, in 1920, Dr. Papanikolaou realized that he could tell the difference between normal and malignant cells of the cervix under a microscope. And so in 1925, with funds from the National Research Council, as well as the Medical Health Committee, he recruited a bunch of volunteers and did a systematic study of cervical cell morphology. And this is, again, where he found that he was able to detect even precancerous cells of the cervix. Mm. Now, he presented these results in 1928 and suggested that swabs of the cervix could be done as a easily performed screening test for early detection of cancerous and precancerous cells.
Mm.
However, as with many kind of groundbreaking discoveries, he was initially met with a lot of resistance. Yeah. And it wasn't until he published a subsequent larger study in 1941 that the Pap test really began to take effect and take hold. Within a few decades of Pap tests being instituted as routine screening, countries that implemented them saw dramatic declines in the cervical cancer incidence, as well as mortality. And this is up to a 70 to 80% reduction.
Like, we're talking, this saves millions of lives.
Millions of lives globally, millions of lives over time. And cervical cancer actually shifted from one of the most common causes of cancer death in women to a far less frequent diagnosis, especially in high-income countries with organized screening protocols.
Wow. It's really important then.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's special because it doesn't just detect cancer. It looks for pre-cancer, right? Yes. Which means we're able to intervene before these lesions ever become a cancer.
Yeah, which is something that I think we'd like to apply to every type of cancer one day. But
exactly,
the fact that we have these resources and the ability to detect that, that's why we promote regular screening.
Exactly. And the other incredible thing about Pap tests is that they're simple. So they can be done with high reproducibility between physicians at many different levels and levels of expertise. They're inexpensive, and it was also scalable as a public health measure. So really, it was like the perfect screening tool in many, many ways.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Now, moving forward, I think it's well worth asking, what causes cervical cancer?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we're looking for these precancerous changes, but are there things that we can even assess for to get ahead of it even further?
Yeah, right? To prevent that from causing the cervical
cancer. Before the cells even start to change, to even develop that precancerous state.
Yeah. And that's when we're getting into HPV, right?
100%. That's where HPV comes in.
Yeah.
So HPV, or human papillomavirus, is a sexually transmitted infection, but it is the most common sexually transmitted infection and ultimately one of the most common viral infections worldwide. Yeah. It's transmitted predominantly through sexual contact, but upwards of 90% of sexually active people will be exposed at some point.
Oh, wow.
So it really is just like super, super, super common.
Yeah.
Most HPV infections are transient, so there's no treatment for them, but we clear them on our own in our system within about 1 to 2 years.
Yeah.
Only a small proportion of infections actually persist in the long term. And the incidence of HPV infection really peaks in adolescence and young adults, coinciding with the onset of sexual activity, right?
Yeah.
So because it's everywhere, right? Yeah. Because everyone has been exposed to HPV, really our first points of infection where that incidence peaks is going to be at the time of first sexual contact.
Yeah.
So again, why exactly is this important to cervical cancer rates? Well, there are more than 200 known kinds of HPV. So there are lots of different strains of HPV. And about 40 of those infect the genital tract. So that includes the cervix, the vagina, and the vulva, but also for men includes the anus and the penis, right? And these 40 are divided into high risk or oncogenic types, right?
Yeah.
There's about 14 types that are really strongly associated with cervical cancer development in particular.
Okay.
And most important of those are HPV 16 and HPV 18, which together cause about 70% of cervical cancers.
Mm-hmm.
Low risk type includes things like HPV 6 and 11, which don't cause cancers, but cause about 90% of genital warts, right? Which is the other thing associated with HPV infection.
Yep.
Now, more than 95% of cervical cancers are caused by some strain of HPV.
Yeah.
Right? And so that is why, although there are a small amount of non-HPV associated cervical cancers, that's why getting ahead of HPV and getting kind of our arms around prevention
is huge.
That is why that is really like HPV is the key to prevention of cervical cancer.
And I think there's a lot of online stigma as well around HPV and how it's, you know, seen as shameful or, you know, only amongst those with promiscuous behavior and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You see tons of that online. And the reality is it's nearly universal and it's as common as catching a cold.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're here to get away from the stigma and to raise the conversation and just know that it's important to talk about and it's important to screen for.
Yeah.
Because this is what prevents
Yeah, cancer. Absolutely. And listen, as an aside, we've talked about genital cancers in the context of this, but HPV is also responsible for a lot of throat cancers, a lot of tonsillar cancers, and cancers of the base of the tongue. So oropharyngeal cancers.
Well, which is still just as important as well to prevent and treat if we can.
Exactly, exactly. So getting into prevention, right? Yes,
vaccinations, right?
Enter Gardasil and other HPV vaccinations.
Yes. I remember that so much from like growing up, because that's kind of when it came to into schools, when they started to mass vaccinate
when girls. When we were young was really the introduction of Gardasil.
Yeah.
I actually remember when Gardasil first became available in Canada and when it kind of landed in my hometown.
Yes.
You know, I feel like we've given your mom, Big Sam,
yes,
a few shout outs on this podcast, but allow me to give Judy, my mom, a shout out here too.
Yeah.
Judy is on it for vaccinations.
Amazing. And
on it for these preventative healthcare measures.
Yeah.
I remember being dragged into my family doctor, myself and my two younger sisters,
to have it.
It felt like the day Gardasil was available.
Wow. That's amazing.
She brought all of us in, no questions asked, and we were all getting vaccinated.
Yeah. And her having three girls too.
Exactly.
It was important for her. And, you know, aside from that, my, my mom, I know she was hesitant with Gardasil because she was just not sure about the evidence. She needed to research it for herself. And I think that that's also a common thing too, that a lot of people feel. And like now she knows. And I obviously, I still had, I was given the Gardasil vaccination, but it can, when something is new, I think it can be scary.
Oh, 100%.
But now we have so much more information about this and how important it is for young women to have.
Well, and you know what? I think there was a lot of stigma around it at the beginning as well.
Yeah.
Right? Because it was a vaccine for a sexually transmitted infection that was aimed at young girls.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And, or at least the public health introduction was aimed at young girls at the time.
Yeah.
And I think necessarily there was, in addition to, I think, some questions that parents must have had, given that this was really groundbreaking to have a vaccine for, you know, the main cause of cancer at all, right?
Yeah.
Which is incredible, but also a new concept at that time, you know, in many ways.
Yeah.
I think there may have also been a little bit of moral panic at the time,
That's the thing, right?
About like, vaccinating girls who largely had were pre-first sexual contact, right?
Exactly.
For a sexually transmitted infection.
Yeah.
And I remember reading a lot of assumptions at that time that it was somehow condoning early sexual activity.
Yes.
As opposed to really what it was, which was, again, trying to get ahead of an STI that is nearly ubiquitous, right? And that is responsible for the overwhelming majority of a really serious cancer, right?
I remember being confused about that as a child, because I mean, I don't know how old I was when I actually got it. What's the usual age nowadays that they're giving the...
So now we're recommending Gardasil between the ages of 9 to 12.
9 to 12. Right? So I was probably in that range. And
in
I remember,
most programs.
Yeah, I remember being confused as to what it was.
Yeah.
Because I think there wasn't a lot of open discussion about it either. And I was always interested in medicine and like what was going into my body. Yeah. I just, that was fascinating to me. And I think, you know, my mom and my teachers and everyone, they didn't want to explicitly say what it was for because of that.
Kind of like that a moral idea panic of about,
like, like, am I condoning sexual, early sexual behavior amongst these girls? Right. So, it's interesting to talk about and to think about, but at the time, I didn't care. I still got it and moved on with my life,
and
I feel
and
I feel good about it. Yeah, I'm happy my parents made that decision for me. But
oh my goodness, of course, same. And it's also evolved over time.
Yeah.
So the HPV vaccine initially targeted four high risk strains of HPV. Mm. Right now, it has evolved actually to include nine strains of HPV that we are vaccinating against. And really, countries that have instituted strong early vaccination programs are seeing a near elimination of cervical precancer in the younger generations, right? It's not entirely eliminated because there still are other strains of HPV that can cause changes to the cervix, but it is quite remarkable the effect of this vaccine and how positive the impact has been for public health. HPV vaccination really has the potential to make cervical cancer a rare disease globally, which what other cancer right now do we have the opportunity to do that with, right? Like, it's a remarkable place that we're there with. Because again, it's life-saving because it, if we're talking about real preventative medicine, you want to get ahead of the first thing in the chain of events that sets off the course towards a serious disease, right? Yeah. And this prevents infection in the first place. So right now, the recommendation is for girls and boys to get it, right?
Yes.
Before sexual activity begins, ideally at the ages of, again, 9 to 12 in most programs for maximum protection. Now, getting vaccinated is still beneficial later. And that's a question that I get a lot of my patients asking
me.
Certainly, there's strong evidence for benefit up to the age of 26 if you're not fully vaccinated. Yep. Although, truthfully, the vaccination benefits extend beyond
that. Yeah.
The main holdup to vaccinating just everybody is the public health benefit for a covered service, at least in Canada, where we have a public health care system.
Exactly.
It starts to decrease once people have been exposed to more and more strains of HPV. Yes. So what that means is that typically the vaccine may not be covered, right, at older ages. But I have patients in my clinics who are vaccinated well into middle age.
Yeah. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're like, oh, I actually don't know if I can get it and I'm 26 years old or whatever, go to your family doctor, ask, look at your history if you did get the HPV vaccine, and then you can get it even at that age.
Yep. My advice, and this is obviously a simplification, is that anyone with a cervix, an anus, or a throat should get the HPV vaccination.
Amazing. Yep.
Now, we have some new guidelines as well. Like, HPV is becoming a little bit more in our language, where previously I found I was having to, like, educate a lot of people on what Gardasil, like, the, I shouldn't use the brand names because there may, in fact, be more now. We're not getting paid by any drug companies here.
No, no.
But the HPV vaccination, right? Yeah. And the HPV vaccine and what relevance that had towards cervical cancer.
Yeah.
However, as of March of this year, the province in which we work and live, Ontario, is now has changed our guidelines for cervical cancer screening. So now we are testing HPV first, which is really, really cool. So basically through the same structure of a test that you would have previously, that same speculum, that same broom around the cervix, we are now able to first test for HPV. What that has resulted in is that the guidelines have now moved from pap test to every 3 years to pap test every 5 years. And I know I have a lot of patients and even a lot of like women in my life who have been really freaked out by that, right? Saying like, why on earth would I want to be screened for this really serious thing later, right? No one likes getting a pap test, but I think lots of people have bought into the fact that it is a necessary component of taking care of your cervical health, right? The reason for that, again, frames back to what we've been discussing already. HPV for upwards of 95% of cervical cancers is the first domino to fall, right? And cervical cancers take a long time to develop, right? They take time to develop into pre-cancer and then time to develop into cervical cancer. And so what this 5 year means is not that we, it's not that we are pushing things out longer. It's that we're testing before we would have gotten to the point of cell changes. Now, what practically happens now is if your HPV test is positive, the labs do what's called reflex cytology, which means they use that same sample that tested for HPV to then look at the cells to tell whether there are any abnormalities.
Okay.
And that dictates what's happening next with respect to screening and moving forward for any treatment or further assessment. So it's not as if we never look at the cells now, right? But now we're looking for that first domino first, right? And if you're HPV negative, we know that the chances of having abnormalities in the cells is extremely low. Now, a question I had when this all came about was there are cancers that are not HPV mediated.
Right.
And if we're not looking at the cells primarily, are we missing those cancers? The answer practically is likely not. And it's because we weren't very good at testing for them in the first place. So things like gastric type adenoma, which is the most frequent true non-HPV subtype, as well as things like clear cell and endometrioid cervical cancer, they have a pap test has always been less sensitive for testing those things.
Okay.
So it's cytology has often missed those cancers in the past. And that's why the guidelines have it's not that we're excluding those or excluding people who may be susceptible to them or may develop those in the future. It's that we were never very good at it to begin with.
In the first place.
Exactly. Exactly. And so we are improving the vast majority of cervical cancer detection and not necessarily losing any ground with the non-HPV mediated subtypes.
That makes sense. Now, question for you. What when you do test for the HPV, what happens if you do come back HPV positive? Like, what's the next steps in that process?
That is a great question.
Yeah.
And what happens depends a little bit right now in Ontario on the type of HPV that you test positive for and whether there are any abnormalities on the cells, on your reflex cytology.
Okay.
So right now, HPV positive for the highest risk strains, regardless of whether the cells are normal or abnormal, means a visit to colposcopy.
Okay.
Similarly, if you are HPV high risk or HPV other positive, and you have low grade or high grade changes to the cells on the cervix, that again means visit to colposcopy.
Okay. So what is colposcopy for people who don't know what that is?
That is a great question. So
because it sounds like a scary, weird word.
It sounds like a scary, weird word. It is literally just a word meaning we look with a microscope at the cervix.
Okay.
So it is not as scary as it sounds. Although again, it's as with many of these pap test kind of investigations, it's no one's favorite doctor visit, right? Okay.
Yeah.
But it does mean you come to see a gynecologist like myself.
Yep.
Who will look at the cervix under a microscope.
Yep.
We apply actually like a medical grade vinegar to the cervix itself, acetic acid. And what that does is it shrinks the cytoplasm in the cells of the cervix. Mm-hmm. Now, if we can think back to like grade 12 biology, I'm sure we've all learned like the parts of the cell, right? Yes.
Yeah.
And we're familiar with the concept of the nuclei, right? Where the DNA components of the cell are contained, right? Abnormal cells have abnormal nuclei.
Okay.
They're like chunkier and bigger and irregular.
Yeah.
So what happens when we apply the acetic acid is the cytoplasm, the soup that the components of the cell are hanging out in, shrinks and atrophy and dehydrates, right?
Yeah.
For normal cells, we don't really see anything at all.
Okay.
But abnormal cells, because they have bigger nuclei, look whiter.
Oh, interesting.
And so we look for these abnormal areas on the cervix and potentially take biopsies of those areas to look at it under a microscope with enhanced detail.
Interesting. Okay? So is this procedure painful? Is it something you need to take time off of work for? Like, what is it like? What can patients expect from this?
I would say that everybody experiences it a little bit differently, like everything. Mm-hmm. It is an uncomfortable procedure. Yeah. Pap tests are uncomfortable for many women.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say like it is or isn't uncomfortable, not because I want to like discount the discomfort associated with colposcopy, but rather that like some women have a really hard time just with a speculum, right?
Yeah.
For reasons that have nothing to do with their own like pain thresholds and everything to do with the fact that we experience these things and we experience pain differently.
Yeah.
So for some people, it can be really, really uncomfortable. For other people, it is, you know, less bothersome.
I am in maybe the minority, but I prefer a plastic speculum.
Oh, interesting.
Because I find, I think that all speculums should be plastic, which I know is terrible for the environment and it should be reused. But but I find the cold metal speculum is like so jarring. I don't know why that is, but
cold metal speculum was developed a long time ago. We could do a whole episode on the history of the speculum.
That'd be kind of cool,
honestly.
Maybe we're the only ones who find that cool, though. So let us know if that's nerds.
If you want me to talk more about speculums in general and their design and some of the newer designs that are out there.
I'm all for the plastic ones, but anyways, I digress.
I would say that people can experience some pelvic discomfort from the speculum itself.
Yeah,
I would say that people can experience some discomfort from cervical biopsies, should you require
some cramping
them, right?
Kind of feeling,
some cramping, some pinching.
Okay. Do you freeze the cervix?
We don't traditionally freeze the cervix for the biopsy itself.
Okay.
Although I'm happy to offer it for people who would like it.
Okay.
The general thought is that for a biopsy, certainly if I'm doing a cervical procedure or if I'm trying to pass something through the cervix, like an IUD or an endometrial biopsy, I find cervical freezing really helpful.
Okay.
The cervical freezing for the purposes of the biopsy, I do find practically, and please, if there's evidence to suggest otherwise, let me know in the comments. I do find that the freezing takes longer and can be more uncomfortable for some people than the biopsy itself. Because
it's so quick, the biopsy.
Because the biopsy is so quick for the most part.
Yeah.
But again, I stand corrected if the evidence is not in support of that. And I'm very happy. I've had patients request a cervical block, and I'm happy to provide it. That is not a problem.
Okay.
And as far as time off work, I do find that a lot of patients prefer to take the afternoon off work.
Okay.
After doing so, because they may experience some cramping. And honestly, you know what? It's stressful to come to these visits. So
of course.
What you do, whether you go back to work or not, is not my business. But one of the nurses that works with me and I have coined what we call a colposcopy treat, which is that after you come to colposcopy, you deserve a treat.
Absolutely.
So
any OB appointment or anything that involves a speculum, you absolutely deserve a treat.
Yeah. Yeah. So listen, what you do with your workplace is none of my business. However, I do strongly recommend colposcopy treat.
Yes.
Get yourself a treat afterwards, whatever that, from whatever form that takes for you.
Yeah. For me, it would be a Starbucks refresher, probably.
Starbucks, if you'd like to sponsor colposcopy clinics, please, I'd be happy to provide people with a little token for colposcopy treat.
Okay. So quick myths I want you to bust. Mm-hmm. If you have HPV, you should stop having sex.
So we actually don't recommend abstinence for HPV positivity.
Okay.
The reason is that HPV is one of the most commonly transmitted sexually infections, and it is very easily transmittable. By the time that people have tested positive, HPV is kind of just doesn't matter. Exactly. And so abstinence is not actually routinely recommended for people who have HPV infection. Again, most partners are already going to share the virus, so it's impossible to know who transmitted it first. Having HPV as well also doesn't mean that anybody has been unfaithful or that a partner is at risk of like a new infection from you specifically.
Okay.
There's also no treatment for HPV infection, and the vast majority of them clear up on their own, no problem.
Okay.
Abstaining from sex is certainly a reliable way to prevent getting or passing on HPV.
Yeah.
But again, it's not necessary once somebody already knows they have the infection.
Okay. Is that something that like you should talk about with your partner and be like, well, we need to use a condom kind of thing? Or is it just what would you recommend as the provider?
So using condoms every time you have sex can lower the chances of passing HPV as well as developing HPV-related diseases, but they don't provide complete protection.
Okay.
So again, it's more that HPV is readily cleared, there's no treatment for it, and by the time you test positive, your partner probably already has it.
Gotcha. So
vaccination is really the best way to prevent HPV transmission.
So that's kind of leads to my other myth. If you already have HPV, the vaccine won't help?
No, because you may not have been exposed to every strain of HPV, right? Gotcha. And there are many strains of HPV, as we talked about. Mm-hmm. And the vaccine is highly protective, right? Yeah. So we still do recommend if you have not had the vaccine or you fall into that vaccinable population, especially those under the age of 26, we do recommend still getting the vaccine, even if you are HPV positive for one strain, because it will protect you against the others reliably.
Okay. Now, if you get the vaccine, does that mean that you no longer need any screening?
Absolutely not. It's highly protective, but it does not cover for every high-risk HPV type.
Okay.
And screening is still needed because it's possible, although less likely, to develop precancer from a strain not covered in the vaccine.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So something that I've also had patients ask, especially patients that are our age, is should they be revaccinated now that we have an updated HPV vaccine? And there's kind of a two-part answer to that.
Okay.
From a health perspective, yeah, absolutely, right? There have been studies that have shown that there is additional immunogenicity benefit to being vaccinated with the non-valent vaccine, so the 9-strain vaccine, after you've already been vaccinated with the quadrivalent vaccine.
Okay.
The challenge is that from a public health standpoint, the cost effectiveness is less favorable for revaccination compared to just a robust primary vaccination campaign.
Okay.
And so it doesn't tend to be covered to have the revaccination. However, if it's covered under your health plan or if you want to get it and the cost, the burden of the cost of it is not cumbersome to you, then absolutely there's no reason that you could not get revaccinated with the non-avalent vaccine, even if you've already been vaccinated with the quadrivalent, the four strain.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Maybe I need to be booking an appointment for that because I definitely don't have the updated version.
Honestly, I don't either. And yeah. I've been thinking lately that I should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's also talk about, you know, the social media buzz that's going on, which is mm-hmm. like the idea of self-swabbing at home. Mm-hmm. I want you to talk about that more.
I'm in support of this.
Okay.
So there is robust evidence to suggest that human papillomavirus mm-hmm. self-swabs mm-hmm. Are a good alternative to mm-hmm. clinician-collected samples for HPV testing. There have been multiple large studies and meta-analyses which have demonstrated that when we're using good validated ways of assessing them, the sensitivity and specificity, so the likelihood of picking it up and the likelihood of a positive test being HPV positivity truly is just as good between self-selected or self-collected swabs and clinician-collected samples. Some of the benefits to it as well would be, you know, access to care, I think, and barriers to access to care are a major reason why some rates of cervical cancer do persist, right?
Yeah.
There are a lot of people for whom getting a speculum exam can be a traumatic event, right? There are people for whom seeing doctors is a traumatic event.
Yep.
And the ability to self-swab, to even potentially have mailing, strategies for this in the future is a really promising avenue. And there are some provinces in some areas of the world that have already started to implement. They've already started to implement like self-swab protocols.
That can be like a game changer for equity in screening, I think. Like that is absolutely amazing.
Absolutely. The one thing that is a little bit lacking with it is that the reflex cytology. So again, we talked about like if you're HPV positive, the lab then looks at the cells themselves. Right. After we've established whether HPV is present or not.
Okay.
So the reflex cytology for self-collected swabs is less reliable than for clinician-collected.
Okay.
However, as a primary method of screening, I still think that this has a lot of promise for the future and the opportunity really to address a lot of barriers to accessing appropriate cervical cancer screening.
I feel like this is also a really important aspect for people who live in rural areas too, who don't have access to clinics and stuff where they can go and have a swab done by a provider. This could be really, really a game changer, as I've said before, but a game changer for people who live in those areas too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really exciting time for risk reduction for this cancer in particular.
Yeah.
Because there are so many new avenues to really pummel the rates of cervical cancer down. Yeah. And it's a horrible cancer when it does occur.
Yes.
So it's just incredibly promising. And the researchers and public health advocates that have been working on this for so long really are deserving of all of our like praise and loud accolades with respect to this, because it's truly remarkable what people have been doing and what we've been able to produce.
Yeah. Yeah.
I say we because I kind of count myself as part of the discipline creating this.
Yeah.
But I wish I was part of some of this advocacy. I have not been, but I am sitting in the background applauding my colleagues who have been, because it's incredible.
Huge.
It's an incredible.
This is incredible. This is what truly I love about medicine, right?
Yeah.
It's that preventative care.
Yeah.
That is so big and is life-changing for so many women in the future. Right?
100%. I've been telling my patients as well that primary HPV testing in particular has been something that gynecologists have been asking for a long time. It used to be that family doctors could not send an HPV test, and we could only really send it and have it be covered by the government at certain key points in a colposcopy pathway. And so having this be more accessible for everyone is as you've said so aptly a few times, it's a game changer.
It's a game changer.
Really?
Yeah.
It's really a game changer.
Truly. Mm-hmm. Okay, so some take-home messages from this episode. We hope that, you know, we simplified the guideline changes for everyone, because I know that that can be that can be panicking for some and confusing, and fewer tests doesn't mean less care.
Yeah.
It means better science and better access to care, which is good.
100%.
Yeah.
Cervical cancer is really, we are inching closer every day to it being almost entirely preventable.
Yeah.
Pap testing really started this revolution, right? So like looking at the cells of the cervix under a microscope, HPV testing as like the first step is really kind of the next chapter, the evolution of cervical cancer screening.
Yeah.
And I think the greater availability of self swabs has the potential to break down those barriers even more that are preventing individuals from being able to access appropriate cervical cancer screening.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Megan, I have one last question before we kind of head off from this episode. I feel like pap tests get a huge bad rap online and just from talking to other women because people don't like having the speculum exam, right? It can be painful. It can be uncomfortable. No matter what your history is, people avoid it.
Yeah.
How do you recommend patients go about that if they're feeling very anxious about the appointment? If they've been putting it off, what are some tips and tricks you can give people so that they can feel better about going into that appointment so that they don't feel like they're avoiding it entirely?
I mean, I think the first thing, first and foremost, I hope that in providing this kind of information in this episode, we're allowing people to reclaim the, you know, autonomy over their own health and that this greater understanding of why pap tests are important, why cervical cancer screening is important, allows people to feel more in control over their current health and their long-term health outcomes as well, right? Yeah. I hope people get as excited about cervical cancer screening because I think even in the face of something that really sucks to get, if you at least understand the why and like buy into, you know, the importance of it, it softens the you know, the crappy parts of getting the pap test. But for a lot of people, no amount of information makes a pap test any easier, right?
Yeah.
For those people, I think the number one thing to do is to have a provider that you feel like you can express these concerns with, right? As providers, there are a lot of ways that we can make speculum exams, that we can make pap tests and cervical screening more comfortable for patients.
Yeah.
The different tools that we have at our disposal differ depending on what the concern is. But as with anything, feeling as though you can express those concerns in a safe place, feeling as though you can show up having not had a pap test in many years and not feel shamed, but rather be celebrated for taking control over this aspect of your life is really the most important factor.
Yeah. I know that I also, like I had my pap test when I had my IUD inserted and that was a way to kind of kill two birds with one stone. And I also had, I brought my friend with me, you know, and just having that support and that's okay. Like if you need to do that to have your routine cervical cancer screening done, there's nothing wrong with that. And don't feel shame about that. Just be open and honest with your providers.
Yeah.
Like Dr. Megan just said, it's part of her job and she's here to support you. So
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So listen, guys, have you heard about HPV testing as opposed to cervical cytology or pap test? Did you know the difference already?
Yeah. Is this all new information you had no idea about or have you heard about it? Let us know. Comment on our social media posts at the.push.podcast. You can email us at askthepushpod@gmail.com. Just let us know. We love to keep this conversation going.
Tell us your stories of getting your pap test, of going to colposcopy, and let us know as providers how we can make this
better,
a better process for everybody involved.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys. I'm getting tired, clearly. Thank you for listening. And make sure you tune back next week for a new episode of the Push Podcast.
See you next time.
Bye.